Okay, thank you everybody for coming, and welcome to the last panel of the day. Thank you for your stamina. We're going to be talking about the impact of new technologies on scientific publishing and on the article in particular. I've taken out the word 2.0 because I'm getting an allergic reaction to it, but that is part of what we're going to be talking about. On our panel today, we've got a great panel, Matt Cockrell, who's the publisher of Biomed Central, which publishes more than 160 peer-reviewed online journals. We've also got Melissa Hagman from the Open Society Institute, where she runs the Open Access Program in the developing world. And we can think of her as one of the originators of the idea of open access, which we're going to get a definition for. Timo Hanne, who runs web publishing for the Nature Publishing Group, which publishes the journal Nature, which many of you might be familiar with, and who is also responsible for bringing Tim O'Reilly into this with the SciFu conference last year. And Amit Kapoor, who is a technologist with many years of experience working in and around the semantic web, who most recently put together the technical publishing system behind a new journal system called PLOS One. So I'm going to just do a couple of quick slides to set some tone for the discussion today. And the theme that's going to come back and forth through this is the idea that we used to communicate scientific information by writing it down on a piece of paper and mailing it off to someone who published it. This is the first journal ever published. It was published in 1665. And this is what it looks like today. It's a little different. And the idea of the scientific article, something that you write down on paper and mail around, is sort of being reconstructed, in many cases, by the people sitting to my left today. So Nature Publishing Group has an effort called Conatea, which is a collaborative filtering system. This is the tag cloud for Conatea as of this morning. And so instead of, again, having these sort of unitary flat panels of information, we have a forest of information and we have a forest of contributions to that information. This is from PLOS One, the site that Amit built, which shows both an article and an annotation that links to databases out of that. And so if we think about Web 2.0, some of what we're thinking about is this kind of stuff. So before we go any further, I'm going to actually ask for a couple of definitions from the panel. So I'm going to have Melissa define open access for us. I'm going to have Timo define Web 2.0 for us. And I'm going to have Matt define semantic web so that we understand what we mean when we're talking today. So why don't we start actually with Timo and Web 2.0?
Thanks, John. Web 2.0 is a multifaceted concept, some would say an ill-defined concept, but as articulated by Tim O'Reilly, it's a concept that's had quite an influence on us as a scientific publisher. For me personally, it's really a set of observations and principles about really clueful and effective use of the web as a communication medium. When Tim O'Reilly talked about Web 2.0, he talked about concepts like architectures of participation, which is really about network effects and collaboration online. He's more recently started articulating that as the concept of harnessing collective intelligence, the sort of Wikipedia type process, if you like. But there are a whole bunch of other concepts that fall into it. The long tail, Chris Anderson's original article in Wired happened to appear the same month that the original Web 2.0 conference was held, back at the end of, I think it was 2004. And the long tail with companies like Amazon, again, has come to be a concept that's been associated with effective use of the web as a communication and also as an e-commerce medium. Things like open APIs and mashups, which relates very much to issues in science about open data and open access that we'll be discussing. Also interface issues, AJAX, use of AJAX. And just the way that you develop applications online, the concept of perpetual beta, applications that are never finished, they're under continual evolution and development, and the concept of the web as a software development platform. Those are all things that have really informed our thinking as a scientific publisher, because we see ourselves as a facilitator of scientific communication, not necessarily a publisher of journals, although that's the way that it's been manifest in the past.
So that's sort of the first aspect of this, the collaborative web. We're also going to be talking about the semantic web, which is a different way of structuring some of the underlying information for machines. Matt, can you go into a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John. So the starting point for the semantic web is really the realization that increasingly the readers of web pages are not just humans, in fact, not even primarily humans in the future. More and more, there are robots and computers which are picking up data from web pages. And so it's no longer sufficient to just think in terms of web pages as being like electronic paper. They have to be as meaningful as possible to those computers which are scanning them, so they can combine information from different web pages and sift through it and make sense of it. A simple example might be a weather page, which would say, for example, that the weather in Austin on Tuesday is going to be sunny, have a nice icon showing the sun, and it's going to be 75 degrees. And that's okay if you're a human. But to a computer, those are just kind of words and characters, and it's not unambiguous what it means. And so you need to come up with standard ways to express the concept of time and what date you're talking about, and the concept of temperature and geographical location. And so the semantic web is about defining standards for that and ensuring that web content includes that kind of information so it can be read by these computers and combined. And in terms of this panel, that's very relevant to science publishing and the communication of scientific research results. Because in the age of the human genome and techniques which no longer, for example, work with one gene at a time, but work with 20,000 genes at a time, there's a flood of data. There's more information than humans can possibly read and combine and reconcile with other data. And so you need to have these semantic web tools which can sift it and make sense of it. And so that's a lot of activities going on right now in finding out how we can help scientists publish the results of their research in ways which capture the semantic structure, the meaning of the research results in a way that computers can then make sense of.
And so both the Web 2.0 and the semantic web aspects tie back to the underlying full text of a scientific article, which, if you go back to the introduction, is something that used to get written down on paper and mailed around. And so legally, copyrights attach to that free text, to that expression. And so it's very difficult to have the discussion about the technology that's happening without some discussion of the underlying arguments that are taking place about access to that full text. And the common name for that is open access. And since we have Melissa, who kind of helped birth the movement, let's get a definition of that, and then we'll get into the meat of the debate.
Okay, thanks, John. Open access is the free online availability of scholarly content. And it was first defined in 2002 in something called the Budapest Open Access Initiative. And the BOAI suggested two strategies for achieving open access. One, the development of open access journals, and two, the development of repositories, either institutional or subject-based. So in terms of open access journals, these are journals which are freely available online and do not rely upon subscriptions to generate their revenue. And we actually have the two leading open access publishers here with us on the panel in terms of Biomed Central and the Public Library of Science. But of course, you could ask, you know, if these journals do not rely upon subscriptions, then how do they really sustain themselves? Well, they do so by employing a combination of new business models, and among them, the most popular is something called the article processing fee. And this occurs when an article is accepted for publication in a journal, a fee is charged, and this fee is usually paid for by the researcher's research grant itself. So in terms of the second strategy for open access, these are repositories, either institutional or subject-based, and they are archives where authors can deposit copies of their articles which have been printed in peer-reviewed journals. And right now, 92% of publishers actually allow authors to deposit a copy of articles which have appeared in their journals and archives. Now, just very briefly, the role of the research funder in the open access movement has become quite important over the past few years, because now the research funders themselves are really taking an interest in open access because they want to maximize the dissemination of the work which they fund. So now many research funders are actually mandating open access to their research, and the Wellcome Trust in the UK was the first to actually do this, and now we have a bill before the Senate. And also in the UK, about five of their research funding agencies have now mandated it as well.
Thanks, Melissa. So Web 2.0, semantic web, and open access are the themes that we're going to come back to sort of again and again over the next hour. And we've got a few set questions and discussions, and then we're going to try to keep at least 10 minutes or 15 minutes at the end to take questions from the floor. So the first theme of the discussion is really that as we move into this collaborative web and machine-readable web world, and we argue about the freedom or the access to the underlying text, one of the key ways that we measure impact in science is starting to change. The way that you usually measure the impact of an article is the number of times it gets citations in other articles. And these are much different than hyperlinking. The idea of an impact factor or impact through citation doesn't really understand the ideas of blogging and tagging and commenting and annotations. So I was going to start by asking Timo specifically what they're seeing in the context of impact at Nature, because you know Nature's actually got an enormous sort of Web 2.0 effort going on. And so I was going to ask Timo, what are you seeing in terms of the impact measurements or metrics that you can generate for articles, and how are those being affected and driven and changed by blogging and tagging?
Well, I mean, out there in the sort of formal scientific world, there hasn't yet been much change. I mean, so most scientists are measured still by actually less even the citations to their papers, and it's actually the average citation rate to the journals in which they publish, which is a very crude measure, very ineffective. I think there's a few trends, though, that are promising in the sense of that I think we're going to get a wider variety of much more nuanced and, in a sense, therefore, accurate measures of scientific output by individuals. First of all, to talk about citation statistics specifically, that has historically been a monopoly. ISI, the Institute for Scientific Information, which was originally set up by an academic called Eugene Garfield, but is now owned by Thomson, a large publishing organization, used to have effectively a monopoly on information about which papers cite which other papers, and they still publish the what many people see as the definitive impact factors for journals, which are then used to assess the quality of scientists' output based on the journals or the impact factors of the journals in which they publish. But one of the things we're seeing is that citation data is starting to become available from other sources. So organizations like Google, for example. So Google Scholar conducts automatic citation analysis of the papers it indexes and uses that in its ranking algorithm. So Google kind of have their own collection, if you like, of citation data. It's still proprietary to them, but at least there is another potential provider of that kind of information. Also, an industry organization, a publishing industry organization called Crossref, which exists to enable publishers to link papers to one another. So if a Nature paper, for example, to cite a Biomed Central paper, then we can link to that reliably through a system run by this organization called Crossref. And they also, as a result of the publisher depositions to their system, are building up a database of which papers cite which other papers. So that measure alone is sort of starting to become opened up to a bit, potentially a bit more competition and other ways of using that underlying data to derive measures of impact. But also beyond that, you know, as scientists increasingly blog or use comments, release data sets. There's all these other ways in which scientists can contribute to the sum of knowledge and contribute to the ongoing sort of pushing forward of those frontiers that go well beyond publishing scientific papers in journals. So the means are now becoming available to measure those. So for example, you know, we have things like Connoitteer, for example, which John talked about earlier, which is effectively it's delicious for scientists or for academics. Okay, so it's a social bookmarking or reference management tool. But you know, so one thing that you could do would be to see the frequency with which things are bookmarked in systems like that. Of course, you can also use web access metrics. You can look at how many times papers have been downloaded, and those sorts of things are much more immediate measures of the impact of a piece of scientific research than citation, which takes months or years to measure because you have to wait for subsequent papers to come out. So those sorts of things are becoming possible. Scientists don't blog very much. They don't comment very much, even when commenting systems are provided for them. They're quite conservative, actually, in their behaviors. And part of that, it's a kind of chicken and egg thing, right? So part of that is because those things don't get measured and they don't get credit for them, right, when they're looking for funding. And science is a very competitive arena to work in. You're constantly looking out for new grants and new research funds. And anything that detracts from that, a scientist is unlikely to want to get involved in or spend a lot of time on. But as these things become popular, as they become more established, and particularly as the younger scientists pick them up and use blogs, comments, you know, social networking applications, data sharing applications, those kinds of things that we see in other domains outside science. And as they use those more and they become accepted more, I think we'll see more formal measurement of those kinds of contributions. And certainly talking with funding agencies, they're interested in measuring those kinds of things. But I'm not personally aware of anything that's going on to formally measure that and use that in funding decisions. But I think that will come with time.
So, Timo, what would you say, what are the kinds of things that you might see in terms of measuring the impact? I mean, are we looking at page rank? Or are we going to be looking at trackbacks? I mean, what are the kinds of things that you could start to measure? If we, not even saying what kind of value we attach, what are the kind of things we can measure?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I mean, you say page rank. I mean, page rank, of course, is fundamentally a citation measure, right? I mean, in many ways, page rank itself was modeled on the citation measurements that came out of academic research, right? But we're talking about links rather than citations. Well, I think, you know, some of the sorts of things I mentioned. So I think actually web traffic is a really promising one. The trouble is it's becoming easier. There's a standard called Counter, which is most of the academic publishers sign up to now, I think, which basically enables them to provide, when they're providing subscription titles, provide libraries with information about the usage of those titles so they can make judgments about which ones to buy. But provide them in a standard way with standard definitions so that libraries can reliably compare one publisher's data with another. But one of the side effects of that, it wasn't the original purpose, but one of the side effects of that is it also means that there's a lot of web usage data out there with common definitions and in a common format, or reasonably so, that you could then start to use to measure the impact of the research on the basis of the downloads it receives. So I think things like that. I also think, you know, ultimately things like numbers of comments, numbers of bookmarking, actions, things like that. But those kinds of activities are not yet well established enough or mainstream enough in science for them to be really, really meaningful measures today. I think the one that's out there today that would be most promising would be page downloads.
Matt?
Just speaking from the perspective of another publisher, one of the real problems with citation-based metrics, especially of single articles, is that it takes so long before you see the results. A typical citation will happen 1 or 2 years after the article's published. And so just waiting to see how often an article gets cited, by the time you've found out whether it's highly cited or not, it's kind of ancient history. So that's why we've experimented, for example, with creating highly accessed logos, which articles get if they are, say, in the top 10% of articles for that given journal. And that's really interesting, and I think the authors and the readers find that useful. It's in no way a kind of perfect measure of quality, but I think because there are many reasons, for example, an article might be highly accessed, it might be interesting or findable on Google for all kinds of tangential reasons. But people forget, I think, that the same applies to citations, and that some articles which are citation classics in a way are cited very frequently precisely because they're very profoundly wrong. For example, you know, some sort of Korean cloning experiment that turns out to be wrong. People refer to it all the time, but not because it's a great piece of science. So I think all these things have to be borne in mind. You have different metrics and you have to take them all with a pinch of salt.
So all of this sort of implies new technology that underpins the publishing industry. Amit just went through the process of building out a platform that combines a lot of these tools with science publishing tools. Can you give us a sense of what does it take from a publishing technology perspective?
It's very painful. It really is. I got involved in this about a year ago, and the amount of information you have to deal with is just absolutely amazing. You know, you're coming from a semantic web background. You think, I just need to index an article, extract this much of information, throw into a database, and I'll be done. Well, unfortunately, that is the starting point. The lack of standards, the lack of formats, the lack of agreements on most of these things make it a really, really complicated project to actually manage. In that sense, the semantic web actually played quite a crucial role for us because I think the biggest advantage of semantic web, which is not we don't talk about too much, is essentially that it's an evolving concept. The idea that you don't have one piece of information and that's going to remain the same forever and ever. What the semantic web actually does, it allows you to start with a concept and actually modify it over time. And that was one of the key reasons why we decided to choose that technology. That was one side of it. The second side of it was that, the articles, the scientific articles for us were a starting point. We had two choices. We could go upstream and tell the authors that you need to restructure all your data in this semantic web triples format, which we know is an impossible concept. You know, just getting human beings to talk to each other in a computer language, I think, is a bad start. The other option was, okay, once we publish it, we get the people together to come in and actually work on it and watch and monitor how the community builds up and how they add the information on top of it. So, for example, what you see there is a very, very simple concept of a text annotation. You know, a user can go and select a small piece of text and write in some comments based on that. But that is actually, underneath that is a much more powerful concept where you can have different types of annotations, for example. You could, for example, say that, you know, this premise of this paper has completely been proven wrong by this paper and you can attach it. So for someone to walk in later and actually do a search on it, it becomes a much more intelligent search. They can say, okay, give me all the other papers which are actually saying that this paper is completely wrong. It starts to become much more. And that's where the whole Web 2.0 starts to play a really, really important role into it, where we're trying to get the community to actually come in and say, the basic scientific data, what you're starting with, or your basic scientific material, just your starting point. And that's what we call the concept of a live data. It took 9 months of really, really painful work, of a lot of hours to actually get this done. But we are, I would say, officially at 0.5 release right now. And coming back to what we had said, we are also following what we call the perpetual beta model, because we've realized that this industry is changing so fast that we will not be able to keep track of it. And the idea of waiting 6 months to put out a release, it just not works for us. So we are basically trying to put out a release once every 2 weeks right now. And that itself is an interesting challenge. So
I just want to comment on that, because one of the, and I'm kind of interested in how the other panelists see it as well, because one of the things it seems to me that's been happening with scientific publishing is that with the move online, there've effectively been these two big domains of scientific communication online. There's the journals and the databases. And I think what we're seeing is journals becoming a bit more like databases, in some ways databases becoming a bit more like journals. So what we see with the move online of journals is that the text becomes searchable, but they're also starting to adopt more structure. They're starting to have systems like this that allow information to be layered on top after the initial publication, which is much more akin to what was happening with scientific databases, but historically wasn't something that happened with scientific journals, at least in this way. On the flip side, scientific databases are starting to learn, I think, from some of the things that are happening with journals. So you're seeing more of them thinking about, for example, using peer review is something that we've seen in a number of projects that we're working on, applying peer review, which has historically been the domain of journals, applying that to database content as well. Also, databases getting more and more concerned about formal citability and archiving and versioning and things like that, which is something that the journals have always been concerned with in one way or another. So as we go online, I think we're seeing a blurring of the distinction between what's the database and what's the journal, as well as hopefully journals and databases working well together and linking and so forth.
Matt, do you want to give a quick comment on that?
On which aspect?
On the databases and the journals sort of blurring.
Absolutely. Well, with authors submitting research these days, there's an increasing fraction of research which is associated with original data sets, which can be quite complex. And the goal of any author is to communicate the results of their research so that others can cite them and build on them. And so finding structures for the structured formats for that data so that it can be shared is an important part of the publication process, just as much as it's a part of a database process. So all journals, in a way, these days find themselves, whether they like it or not, associated in a way with a database aspect, with all the data which the researchers have published. And that can be either directly associated with the article, or it can be linked in various ways to the article into various repositories. But what's missing in a way right now are the standards to allow those different types of data to be interwoven. And, you know, I think there are interesting things going on, which maybe we'll talk about later in the panel, which can help to break down those boundaries between the different types of data and make them more interoperable.
So all of this sort of presupposes that there's some foundation of text on which this is all being built. So I'm going to ask Melissa to talk a little bit about how the open access framework really supports some of these things we've been talking about.
Right. Well, as I mentioned earlier, is more and more research funders are actually taking an interest in mandating open access to their research. More and more quality content will be available online, and thus it will open itself up to having other services built upon it.
And how does this fit in with open access from a business model perspective? This is sort of a question I had planned later, but let's go ahead and dive into it.
Biomed Central is a commercial open access publisher, and in a way, there was a couple of things about why we started Biomed Central. At one level, we saw that with the flood of data coming out of biomedical science and other areas of science, that it was there's simply no way it was going to be possible for science to move forwards as rapidly as it could do based on this data, unless there was full and open access to the data and the results of the research to allow different groups, academics, commercial organizations, to keep building and enhancing the tools for working with that research. So at that level, open access as a model was just a logical next step.
Melissa, do you want to add some comment?
No, I was just about to say that open access is really the vehicle which makes these type of models possible now, it seems.
And then the other thing, obviously, is changing the model of the publisher from a model of being a purveyor of content, where the a research publisher acquires content and then resells it, and shifting it to a model where the publisher is a partner to the scientific community and offers a channel to help the scientific community share the results of the research and make it openly accessible. So that's just a fundamental shift of what publishers are doing. They're no longer going around shopping for content and then putting it in a shop window to offer back to the scientific community. It's much more about saying, let's facilitate this exchange of information between different members of the scientific community.
Amit, you want to come?
I think one of the other interesting things there is going to be is that as more and more information, what we refer to internally as overlay information, gets added onto the scientific data, that value in itself for publishers and for other people to come in and develop tools on it creates a very interesting opportunity for a lot of people to actually take advantage of that. It's just not necessarily the publishing process or the underlying, the scientific articles which might have value in the long term, but the actual overlaid data which the community is adding on to it, which can have value also in the long term. So there's some interesting conversations going on that front also.
So Timo, from a more traditional subscription publisher's perspective, how are you looking at business models around some of the sites that you guys have built?
Yeah, so a few things to say about that. So Nature Publishing Group, most of our journals are subscription based, so we rely much more on reader fees, if you like, reader side fees than author side fees. We do have one or two journals that the author pays open access publishing. So for example, we have a journal that we publish together with the European Molecular Biology Organization called Molecular Systems Biology that uses exactly that model. The economics of it are quite challenging, particularly for journals that have a high rejection rate. So for example, for Nature, Nature accepts about 8% of the papers that are sent to it. Okay, so it's a rejection rate of 92%. Very, very selective. And actually, many of our other titles have similar rejection rates. And as a result of that, if you only charge for the publication of those few that are accepted, it ends up being very expensive on a per paper basis. For highly selective journals, the economics are very challenging. And at the moment, we can't make ends meet on that kind of model, except for more specialist titles like Molecular Systems Biology. Having said that, there's a couple of other things to add to that. One is that I think this has come up in passing, but another sort of mode of or route to open access is not just open access publishing, but the self-archiving. So the authors, the scientists themselves, depositing their manuscripts, sometimes after an embargo period. So, for example, Nature has an embargo period of 6 months, after which the author is able to deposit their manuscript in an archive that might be run by their institution or by their funder. For example, PubMed Central, that's run by the National Institutes of Health. And a lot of content is becoming available that way, or at least it could do. The participation rate of the researchers is not very high, but if it were, then a lot of content could become available that way as well. I think, though, that as we, I mean, the projects that I personally work on are almost all what you would define open access, but they're not traditional journals. I mean, they're not journals by most definitions. So I work on a number of database-related projects, for example, where we rely on advertising, commercial sponsorship, and in some cases grant funding as well to run those. And those are open things like the Signaling Gateway, also a collaboration with the Allen Institute for Brain Science called the Neuroscience Gateway, things like that. These are free resources, free at the point of use for the communities that use them, but do rely on other sources of funding, such as sponsorship and grants. But we're also seeing kind of new models. I mean, there's an analogous situation in other parts of our business. So recently, Nature Jobs, which is our scientific career service, sort of reinvented its business model in a way that's analogous to open access, I think, which is that whereas in the past we charged for print ads and then tried to sell, if you like, by charging a little bit extra, an online ad alongside that, now everything's switched around, and now you can post a jobs ad online in the database for free, and then optionally you can sort of buy services on top of that, such as a print ad or higher visibility for your ad, and so on and so forth. So we also see other parts of our business sort of being turned around by the web in ways that I think are somewhat analogous to open access publishing. When it comes to things that we run, sort of social software projects, if you like, our Web 2.0 projects, things like Nature Network, things like Konatia, those kinds of projects, at the moment, they literally, I mean, with a couple of exceptions, they don't generate any revenue. So for us, they're experiments in trying to sort of build communities, build services, and they are experimental in the sense that, first of all, we're trying to build something that's useful, and then once we realize, you know, once we find out whether it is useful and how people are using it, we'll work out which business model is applicable. But many of them will be oriented around advertising and sponsorship, inevitably.
Well, we're talking in many cases here about biomedical scientific research, and there's a significant component of this which is neither industry nor university nor publisher, which is the government. And so Timo alluded to self-archiving, and Melissa alluded to some of the policy and legislation. So I'm actually going to ask Melissa to sort of tell us a little bit about the history of the policy pressures from the government funding perspective, you know, here and abroad.
Right. So as I mentioned, open access was defined about 5 years ago. And soon after that, governments began to take an interest in open access because they saw that they're basically paying for access to the research twice. Basically, they're paying to sponsor the research itself, and then they're also supporting universities and hospitals to purchase the journals in which that research, which they had initially funded, actually is published. So as I mentioned at the beginning, the Wellcome Trust in the UK, which is the largest private funder of medical research there, was the first funder to actually mandate open access to their research. And I've worked with them a lot, as we all have over the past few years. And I think that really the most powerful reason or image as to why the funders have taken such an interest in this is I heard a story which the director told once, in which he said that, you know, he had provided a grant of like £250,000 to support a research project. And then when he himself went online to access the article on which that research was published, he was denied access because his own library didn't have a subscription to that journal. So he just thought, you know, what is really the impact of this research, which I'm funding, if so few people actually have access to it. So that was really the background of the funders becoming involved. And then after the Wellcome Trust, as I mentioned, in the U.S. now, we're going to have a bill which is going to be reintroduced in the Senate. It's actually sponsored by Senator Cornyn of Texas, and it would mandate open access to the research which the 10 largest American government funding agencies support. So this would include all of the research funded by NIH, by NASA, and the EPA. So the role of the research funder within the open access movement is playing a huge role right now, and I think it will just increase in the coming years.
So I'm gonna take a quick shift over to the Semantic website because we've been kind of focusing on the Web 2.0 side. So just a couple more kind of contextual slides. When we talk about Semantic Web, this is the kind of stuff we're talking about that is the machine stuff. We don't want, as Amit said, to make people say this to each other. This is eye-bleedingly ugly, and it's designed for machines. But what we mean in many ways is we can take a paper. This is a paper from Biomed Central. There's a typical scientific sentence in the box about a regulation between a gene and a disease, a state which is inflammation. And so when we say semantic web, what we mean in many cases is being able to write it in a different way so that a machine can understand that inflammation activates the expression of this particular gene. And what you see is that for each of these cases, for each of these elements, right, the subject, the verb, and the object, we have to have a URL. We have to have a place at which the computers can get a definition or understand. And we have to know a lot of different things. We have to know where this assertion came from. What, did it come from a paper? Did it come from a database? Is that person trustworthy? How old is it? Has it been eclipsed? Has it been commented? Has it been annotated? And so I wanted to sort of ask all of our publisher and technology folks to talk about what kinds of services are required to make this stable, because we don't want these names to go away. We don't want these papers to go away. If we're going to begin to build search and data analytics on top of this stuff, there's a whole set of burdens that fall primarily on the publishers, but that could turn into not just burdens, but revenue opportunities also for vendors to the publishing industry. So I'm going to start at the end and work back with Amit.
Thanks. I get the hardest one. from a technology perspective, I mean, we call it essentially trying to figure out what the vocabulary of that community is. The fact that it's encoded in a URI is just as a detail. And the idea that human beings will actually remember something like this is going to be impossible, right? So what we've done, it is actually a very simple step which we've taken right now. This was after conversations with Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia. The idea behind this one has been, from our perspective, is we're going to let the community actually come in and define these words, actually define what the vocabulary is, define the relationships, and then we'll actually mine or harvest the data and actually make the most commonly used concepts more and more visible. So it'll essentially be both a bottom-up and a top-down approach. Bottom-up, we let the community actually come in and define some of these concepts, but we will have experts essentially be able to come in and say, you know what, folks are using this concept or this relationship on a much more regular basis. Let's see if we can actually bubble it up and make it much more visible so users, instead of defining the same thing again and again, can reuse some of the stuff. So I think for us, it's going to be an interesting challenge how to manage both, for the lack of a better term, the mob aspect of a community to come in and define it, and as well as the experts coming in. And somewhere we have to figure out what a good, intersection of those two concepts would be.
Yeah. I think Amit's hit the nail on the head in many ways. I was going to say exactly the same in terms of bottom-up and top-down approaches to coming up with the right underlying vocabularies to unambiguously capture this scientific data. It's something that's really, held the field back for several years, is the difficulty in coming to agreement about what the best ways to represent certain concepts are. And it's useful that there are organizations like the a newly funded National Center for Biomedical Ontology, where ontologies are these kind of structures of concepts. And also the NCBI, the organization that runs PubMed, is also kind of active in trying to define these standards. But it's really not enough to try and impose top-down standards, especially because the concepts which are trying to be structured are very rapidly changing and growing and expanding. And I think there's a real interaction between the kind of semantic web approaches and the more sort of, the Web 2.0 user-generated concept approaches. And there's a couple of projects Biomed Central is involved with and collaborating with, again with the Wikimedia Foundation. There's a thing called Wiki Authors and Wiki Proteins. Now, authors are just people who write scientific articles, and it seems an incredibly simple concept. But actually keeping track of which author is which is, given that, new people are becoming scientific authors all the time, and people have the same names as other authors, and people's names change, and there are different ways of spelling people's names. It's an incredibly difficult thing, and it gets in the way of keeping track of what's going on in the scientific literature. And wikis can actually play an important role in ensuring that every scientific author is identified in some way with a particular wiki page, just like concepts are identified with, for example, Wikipedia entries. And similarly with proteins, again, they play a very important role as concepts in biomedicine. But it's very difficult because people's understanding of proteins and what we know about those proteins and which different proteins there are in different organisms, that's always changing. And there is a stockpile of proteins which are queued up to be annotated by this kind of consortium based in Geneva called SwissProt. And you can sort of, the graph basically shows that they're going to finish in about 100,000 years time, basically. So clearly waiting for the perfectly curated structure and ontology isn't going to get us anywhere. And that's where these kind of Wikipedia approaches have a huge amount of value. One other thing I was going to mention about how the Web 2.0 fits together with the semantic web is this kind of tagging approach. The great thing with scientific literature and the semantic web is that bookmarking can become much more than simply, you know, keeping a list of your favorite articles. Scientists conventionally do kind of keep little card indexes or online card indexes, or maybe they just photocopy lots of papers and keep them in a drawer and sort of feel like they've collected a repository of knowledge there. But it's kind of very offline and it's difficult to sift through it and mine it. And what's great as we start to be able to embed more computer-readable knowledge into scientific articles is that as somebody bookmarks using Cite-U-Like or Connoisseur or these other systems and tags the articles of interest to them, they can assemble a collection of scientific knowledge which they find particularly interesting or trustworthy, and that can then be used to alert them to future scientific articles that may be of interest to them. And also they can, you know, work with it and mine it. So I think it's, the two things are very synergistic, and we're going to see a lot more of the ways in which these kind of new style Web 2.0 technologies can be applied to semantic web content in a scientific environment.
So, I mean, I would echo a lot of the things that Matt has said. I think the semantic web approaches and the Web 2.0 approaches are highly complementary. I think, you know, just as RDF and ontologies have their place, so tagging and microformats and those other kind of lightweight, less formal approaches also have their place. And the two can work together and they're both useful. Tagging and folk taxonomies gives you much noisier data than something more formal, but it still gives you useful data and you can pull signal out of the noise. And similarly, you know, microformats aren't quite the same as having a formal ontology, but they can be, in the right situation, they can be every bit as useful. So I think those kinds of approaches are definitely complementary. I guess the other thing I'd say, again, I think this echoes a lot of what Matt was saying, is that when you're talking about sort of scientific domain-specific kind of definitions and identifiers, for us as a publisher, it's difficult. It's essentially impossible for us to kind of come up with it and then, if you like, try and impose it on a particular scientific domain. The researchers themselves, A, have the best knowledge for defining what they mean by certain concepts, and B, need to buy into those definitions and those identifiers if it's to be any use at all. But once those things do come up out of the community, we as publishers can and should, do a lot of things that add value off the back of those. So those kinds of things do enable us to better link to and from databases, to provide much more meaningful search facilities and those kinds of things. But that said, I think, you know, it's interesting that Matt touched on the author identification issue, because I was going to mention that as well, because I actually think that's a clear example, actually, where I think publishers collectively have been like shockingly slow in coming up with a reliable way of unambiguously identifying an author. I mean, that is a job for a publisher, right? Coming up with a robust definition of what a gene is or what a species or something is something left for the scientists, and then we can use it. But something like, you know, who is this particular author and how can we unambiguously identify them, is something that publishers really ought to have got to grips with a long time ago. And it's good that we are at last, but we should have done it a long time ago. We've done it for articles with DOIs, digital object identifiers, but not yet for authors.
So a lot of this sort of, we've heard each of the three panelists talk about, you use either the word harvest or the word mine. And open access in the original definition included the phrase, the right to pass literature as data to software. And so, Melissa, you were in the room, but that was a pretty visionary thing. What was behind that?
I was in the room, and there was much interesting debate. I really think it came more from Stephen Harnad and his work with the repositories, and was finally agreed upon as we were drafting the Budapest Open Access Initiative itself. But I think it served that it was somewhat visionary in a res- in a certain respect, because we had no idea how the movement would actually take off in the end. And now having a comprehensive definition as we do, I think, has served the movement quite well in that sense.
Yeah, just so everyone knows, a lot of the contracts that nature doesn't do this, but Elsevier, for example, standard contract with universities, makes it illegal to do this kind of mining and harvesting. And it was one of the reasons that the Public Library of Science was founded in the early days. So we've reached the end of sort of my thematic stuff. Do we have any questions or comments from the floor? And can you give us your name, please, because this is apparently being podcast. So
okay. Andrew Donahoe. I've been in the web a long time and been watching the promotion by Timbal of the semantic web, and I've seen the emergence of tagging as in the Web 2.0 space. And I see a total divergence of ways of attacking the same problem. In many ways, tagging is like the old traditional keywords that went into the keyword databases. You just throw in the things in your abstract that you think the article's about, and then the Googles of the world magically figure out the relevance. Whereas the semantic web is about putting a huge amount more information into every article about whatever it is you're writing. And so I've always been wondering about the semantic web as way too much work has to go into the system before it's useful. And tagging shows that there's a good utility out of not putting too much pre-made information. So I'd like the panelists to address not so much the battle between the two, but the effectiveness of the two different strategies.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons for this panel was to really argue for some consilience between the two approaches. And so why don't we'll start at the left and work our way down.
I wasn't trying to get a battle going.
Oh, no, it's okay. Okay. We can do that too, but we typically have that over copyrights, not over technology.
Right. So I just wanted to talk about effectiveness because Google's been very effective.
Sure. Right.
Okay.
So I guess I'll state it the way. I actually disagree with that idea that these two are two completely different concepts. They're actually one and the same. So if you think about what tagging essentially is, for folks who are, I guess, a little more familiar with the semantic web, it's essentially a way of classifying objects. So when you're going in and adding a tag, you're essentially saying that this object belongs to this class. So actually tagging is a very, very small subset of what semantic web is all about. So they're not different approaches. I would say the tagging is kind of the first step towards the larger vision of what semantic web is all about. Having said that, I think what I'll agree with is your other statement, which is the cost of putting in the semantic web information right now is extremely high. And who's going to bear that cost? Is it going to be the people who are generating the content? And, you know, how are we going to distribute the cost of that? I think that's a much more interesting question. And from Topaz and Applause perspective, that's, as I said earlier, that was the reason why we decided that we are not going to push the cost to the authors. We are not going to tell the authors, go ahead and write your scientific articles in semantic web information. Use your domain knowledge, use English, use whatever language you come in. And then subsequently, as the community comes in together, that's when we will provide the tools on top, where users come in and they see that as just tools which help them do the work, but we translate those actions into much more semantic information which can be searched and taken advantage of.
There's another sort of metaphor to look at here, which is that, you know, certain tasks are of a complexity that they can be almost beyond the scope of any one company. And one of those classic examples is the annotation of the genome. So the genome is a big batch of A's, T's, C's, and G's. Figuring out what parts of that represent active regions, regions that make proteins, regions that are involved in disease, is something that there's, you know, tons of open software programs. There's like 15 you can choose from that will predict the likelihood of a given area being active or not. But it's a completely open approach. And there's actually a really cool system called the Open Annotation Server that lets you, from your client, integrate the annotations from anyone that's using any of the open annotation servers. And this is a case where, you know, no company could do this. There was a biotech company called DoubleTwist that tried to have a business selling these annotations, and they just couldn't cover enough of the genome at a high enough resolution to have a valuable product. And it may well be that the annotation of the literature into a semantic web format requires a peer production model, not something that any one company does. Because if anyone here has ever sat on a standards group, I can tell you that sitting on a standards group for scientists is even harder. It takes an unpleasant process and makes it lengthy. So I think we have to...
I have.
I worked at the Web Consortium. So do we have anything more from the panel, or do we want to get some...
Sure. I was just going to say, I think that you mentioned Google. Google's a great analogy of something which works in practice. And it's quite interesting just how terrible a reputation in some ways Google has with quite a few librarians, and the appalling fact that so many students and even faculty use Google in preference to these kind of services which have been created at great trouble by librarians and are sort of better in various ways in theory. And I think it's important to learn from that in some ways, because the fact is that dozens of years of academic library research has not had anything like the effect on really connecting people with the information they need that Google has. And we see the same thing in a way with tagging, that a decade of semantic web research hasn't had the real world impact that tagging has. But you then see the next stage, which is that once you get to the point where you've got Google or you've got tagging, there are aspects of infrastructure that can actually be organized and can be well structured to help that, achieve more. And so libraries these days do things like they develop link servers which enable their users to go from Google right to the resources appropriate for that particular institution, and that's actually quite constructive. And in the same way, the people working on underlying semantic web technologies now have a decent amount of raw material of tagging data, and there's the ability to say, okay, what sort of infrastructure could we put in place with well-structured semantic, RDF, that would actually help make more use of this? And so I think there is a danger that people can argue over the head of a pin as to which way is technically better to do something while the real world moves on. But on the other hand, once you have some a real-world problem to solve and some real-world world data, it really helps to focus the mind. And some of those technical arcanities, if that's a word, can start to really come in useful in terms of taking things forwards.
So very, very briefly, because we've got a few people that are waiting.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Okay, so we can get our next comment from the floor.
I actually have a very related question, but it's potentially a bit more pragmatic.
Can we get your name, please?
Amy.
Okay.
I actually wanted to know what practical tactics you may be using to leverage tagging and to leverage the user-generated content to influence controlled vocabularies and to build automated generated thesauri. So, I've been thinking a lot about how to bring the two together through information architecture so that the users themselves, through continuously using, say, a pre-served tag cloud, can begin to make those connections for you.
Actually, this is a much longer conversation. I would state it simply that we've taken kind of the first step towards it, and I'll give you some of the straight up problems we ran into. It's that it is so tied into the tools which you're going to actually expose to the users that right now I cannot give you a clear answer to it till the community and the tools get, say, like maybe 2 years from now, I might have a much better answer. But maybe after this panel, I would like to talk to you on what you've been thinking about this. It'll actually help us. So,
one comment I would make on that is there is a huge potential riches of information about the connectivity of different concepts and how the sort of structure of those concepts fits together within user-generated content. But that does depend absolutely on creating a situation in which there's strong user motivation to create that content and annotate that content. And we see a great deal of success in that regard with things like Wikipedia, and that sort of came as a great surprise to many people that it actually took off as it did and that the quality is as good as it is. But we also see huge numbers of examples of experiments from science publishers which haven't attracted anything like that amount of contribution. And so you have to figure out the motivation issues. What motivates people to contribute in one case and not in others? But my understanding is that quite a bit of work's been done on, for example, generating ontologies purely from the connectivity data within, for example, Wikipedia. And you can generate really interesting and well-structured information from that. So if you can motivate the users to contribute the information, then you've got a great source of controlled vocabulary, right?
So go on to our next question, please.
Thanks. My name is Adnan Wasse. I'm a journalist, but don't worry, I'm not here as a journalist. We're talking about scientists talking to other scientists, but I'm also interested in how semantic web ideas can be used to reach the public. And so can you talk about some efforts where these kind of ideas are already being thought about to reach, journalists also, but just reaching the public?
So, I mean, one of the classic arguments for open access is sort of the ability of the patient to get access to clinical trial information and be empowered when they go to the doctor. And I think Google has played a big part in that in certain terms of, my mom knows how to use Google to look up a drug and to look up information on that. But I'm going to throw this to Timo first.
The example for me that springs to mind is not strictly semantic web, I suppose. It's more web 2.0 sort of open data type thing. But let me see if this example kind of answers your question. So it actually comes from one of our journalists, a guy called Declan Butler, who covers actually many things, but among other things, he covers avian flu and other pandemics. Something that he did, this is something he did personally, was to pull together a whole bunch of data sets that were available but had never been pulled together, and particularly had never been pulled together in a machine readable form, about avian flu outbreaks. So we were in a situation where organizations that were collecting information about avian flu outbreaks were not enabling people to really access that information openly or in a useful form. And some of them, in fact, were promising governments that provided them with that information that they would not tell anyone, right? Because governments in providing information are worried about their tourist industries and so on and so forth. And so what we found, so we were in a situation in which the information about avian flu outbreaks was at best fragmented, in some cases, secret. And what Declan did in his spare time, right, was to pull together all this data, all the data he could get hold of, because he was covering the subject as a journalist for Nature anyway, and to make that data available as a KML file. Right, so KML is the format used for Google Earth to display data. And what you get as a result of that is you can view information about avian flu outbreaks through an interface that shows you it's sort of color-coded and size-coded according to whether it's, the degree of the outbreak, and of course you can see what the location of it, the date of it, whether it was a human, whether there were human cases or other species, and so on and so forth. So that kind of information. Suddenly, all that information was available, easy to view, easy to mine, easy to get updated information on it. And for me, that's sort of one of the best examples of someone, using a piece of existing kind of technology and infrastructure, which is Google Earth and KML, not specifically a semantic web technology, but I think rather similar, and using it to suddenly make this information kind of useful and available to people in a way that it wasn't just a few weeks earlier.
So can we get our next question from the floor?
Yeah, it's really exciting to see all this movement towards openness in science and the changes in technology. However, I noticed that there's a certain conservatism in the idea of what a scientific paper is and how a bunch of text becomes part of the scientific canon. And two thoughts came to my mind that might sort of stretch that concept that are facilitated by this sort of free publication environment in which we can sort of put our bits out there without much trouble. One is that in Nature is a particular, is sort of an extreme point in this. If you want a paper in Nature, you have to make it very short. Whereas, in fact, you're trying to convey what you've been doing for the last 5 years. There's a lot of ancillary information that in paper publication we couldn't possibly conceive of having. You're talking about databases, but one case that comes to mind is source code, where in my field, in the climate field, there was quite a controversy about some source code that went away. You may have heard some of it in the press and aren't aware of the missing source code aspect of this. So where do I put my model? Where does someone else put their model so that I can use it? There's a sort of ancillary information that's there. And a sort of more tricky one is, can we think about Web 2.0 in terms of of the peer review process. Mm-hmm. We've defined what peer review is in a sense that depends on the paper technology. And in fact, you were talking about a lot of metadata after the fact. Okay, this paper has been refuted by that paper. But could we think about peer review being in perpetual beta as well? So that a paper is out there and it has some sort of level of influence that rises and falls based on some sort of measure of how influential it is now rather than how influential it was in the past. And that's just a bunch of ideas that came to my mind, and I wonder if you had any responses.
So I think we could probably spend another hour responding to that. But I think we have one more question. I just want to make sure everyone gets a chance to go to the mic, because we have about 30 seconds left before we go over, and they are tough about time here.
Okay, thank you very much. Chris Jones from Radar Networks. And this kind of comes off of Amy's question around, and it was, ontologies sort of have a tendency to become complex. And one of the challenges that we see is that's great for machines, but not so great for users. And if one of the solutions that we're identifying is that users would contribute to the design of these ontologies, it sort of becomes catch-22, where you're asking users to help you with a complex system, which is a naturally something difficult for them to navigate through. And I'm wondering if you've had any thoughts or experiences in those areas.
So we're over time, so I'm going to actually suggest that we all, if you're interested, we'll all hang out in the hallway and have some conversation. So I'm going to sort of exercise my moderator comments. Thank you for coming. If you've got one of those yellow cards, fill it out. If you have something positive to say, hand it to the staff. If you have something negative, I'll collect them. And thank you very much to my panel and to you for joining us, and have a great night here in Austin.
Thanks.